Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Narnia Web Council. I am your host, Rillian, and this is part two of our Voyage of the Dawn Treader film analysis. Today we have, once again, Glumpuddle rejoining us. Hello, Glumpuddle.
Hello, continuing our voyage through Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
Indeed. And then we have Dr. Elwyn Ransom. Hello, Doctor.
Hello, Rillian. I just stepped through the painting, and I'm glad to join the voyage. It's already underway.
Oh, I thought maybe you came from one of the planets instead of the painting. Isn't that where you're supposed to come from?
Malachandra, if you're going with my username, yes.
Okay. Well, let's jump right back into it. In the last episode of this podcast, we finished really right as the Pevensies, Lucien Edmund and their cousin Eustace were going into their room. And that's really the next scene here to discuss. And Glumpuddle, why don't you start off the discussion here, just on some of your overall thoughts on some of the dialogue that we had in the room as well.
Yeah.
And then we'll move to the transition.
Yeah. Well, it starts off, Lucy is just finishing reading Susan's letter. And there's this talk about, Susan gets to do all these cool things and Peter's gone because we're the youngest, nobody cares about us. It's kind of those poor things. And then there's this moment where Lucy is looking in the mirror and she goes, Edmund, do you think I look like Susan? And Edmund completely ignores this kind of weird comment and just starts thinking about the painting. Like, have you seen this ship before? Then Eustace comes in and starts talking about fairy tales and stuff. And then they get sucked in and we're off on the adventure. But I thought that... some of the, like I said, the do you think I look like Susan bit was kind of, it just seemed weird. It seemed like Edmund would have more of a reaction to it, might want to talk about it more, but he completely ignores it. I found that kind of strange. And then let's just breathe a sigh of relief here that when Eustace comes in and says the thing about referring to them as orphans, that they are not literally orphans, that was apparently just Eustace kind of making fun at them. So that was a huge relief.
You never really fell for that. I actually did think, oh my goodness, I bet they've made them orphans to try to make them more vulnerable or something like that. But you were right the whole time.
Yeah. And then I like Eustace's dialogue talking about fairy tales and how people like you always become a hideous burden to people like me. Read books of real information. That's certainly...
That honors the book.
That's a really important part of the book about Eustace thinking he's above those things. And of course, one of my favorite C.S. Lewis quotes of all time, where he said that when I became a man, I put away childish things, including the desire to be very grown up. And I think that's certainly a very important part of Eustace's character in the book, and I think it's honored here.
Yeah, I think that was something... I mean, just one of those little examples where you find a line of dialogue that isn't in the book, but is perfectly in line with the character and what's going on. So, yeah, definitely there. Ransom, how about you? What were your just kind of overall thoughts on this scene?
Well, at this point in the film, I'm starting to recover from some of the moments before. I enjoyed the start, some of the moments you all were talking about in the last podcast, although, some of the things they put in, such as Edmund trying to join the military because he's kind of bitter because he's not a king anymore, didn't seem to have a whole lot of depth to it. But by then, we're kind of back on track. We've got the lines from the book that some of you mentioned, a lot of Eustace's description actually worked into the dialogue. That had me cheering. The whole thing about Uncle Harold behind the newspaper was weird, but catching up to where we were, do you think I look like Susan? That was a bit of a... I remember that working a little bit better in the film. To hear it described now makes it seem like a bit overkill. Okay, I think I understand it now. But I read the book, so I know what that's about. I never had a problem with Eustace talking about the orphans. I somehow missed out on that controversy. I didn't know there was any wondering if they'd somehow killed Mr. and Mrs. Pevensey. I didn't know that was a fear. Eustace's lines about fairy tales, I read books of real information. That was cool. It's like, yes, they got it. They understand. They can be my friends, and I'm totally with them by now.
Yeah, overall, I liked the scene. I thought... I think that as far as Lucy's little comment, I could have taken either that one or the little bit at the recruiting station having both in such a short time frame seemed like she was a little bit obsessing over it. You know,
yeah,
again,
it seemed like overkill.
Could have been a little more subtle. Other than that, you know, it was okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
in terms of the moments where they missed a subtlety, it was one of the lesser moments. There's a few others where it was way overkill.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I like the scene,
yeah.
And I thought it set up the characters fairly well. I will say, though, it was one of the scenes where I was just sort of, I suppose, a little bit puzzled that they didn't include more lines straight from the book, because I couldn't really, it just seems almost, I don't know, almost arbitrary, like, such and such line could have worked just as well, but... you know, again, it wasn't...
Yeah, maybe.
There weren't really a whole bunch of changes or anything, so I didn't really have complaints with it. And overall, I liked it.
But the heart was there.
Yeah.
The heart was there in that scene.
I mean, the part of my... Yeah, agreed. I think the part that really just made the scene special to me really was the transition. And this was, in my opinion, one of the best examples in all three films of, you know, just taking something Lewis wrote and bringing it to screen in a visually exciting way.
Well, of course, if a few details were changed, if I were a nitpicker, which of course I'm not, I would say that, you know, they never actually ripped the painting off the wall, the water didn't mm-hmm. pour out, it didn't fill up the room, and then they're swimming in, you know, instead they just kind of, you know, shrank, or the painting got larger, or such, as book readers will remember. But other than that, I really enjoyed their unique take on it. The effects were seamless. It really looked like, I mean, you could actually see the back of the painting as they took it off the wall. And Eustace, the best part probably was Eustace actually saying verbatim from the book, "I'll smash the rotten thing!" And then Edmund, one could presume, starts yelling at him not to be a fool. And true to form, though, Eustace is a fool, and suddenly his bedroom is flooded, which makes for a very nice reversal at the end of the film. But I really liked the transition, and then, you know, that little bedroom keeps getting bigger, and then suddenly they're in this giant ocean. I really, really liked that.
That's one of the things that you mentioned, the word seamless, and I think you're talking about the special effects, which I'll agree with you on. But one thing I liked was in many of the books, it's hard to, whenever they're going into Narnia, it would be hard to actually pinpoint a specific moment where they're no longer in this world, and they're all of a sudden, boom, a Narnia. It's not like a flash. The closest thing to that is when they, I mean, even from the perspective of the person putting on the ring and the magician's nephew, it's not a boom, instant thing. So I liked that as the viewer, you're not completely sure at what moment they've left the room, what point they're in the ocean.
Well, have you watched some of the behind the scenes about it? They actually had you know, one set that was the room that they lowered in the pool, and then they had this other wider pool, and then finally this giant pool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought the effects were pretty decent. I thought my favorite part as far as effects was when Eustace, when he grabbed the picture off of the wall and the water kept coming out. I thought that was just really, really cool. I guess the scene would have been a little more powerful, I thought, if it didn't happen. It felt to me like it happened very early in the film. And it just seemed like, I still feel like I've just sat down. And maybe it's because it could go back to sort of the lack of opening credits that I've just kind of gotten used to in an Arnie film. It could be that. But apart from that, I thought it was pretty well done, good effects. And I thought that what you were saying, Ransom, about how it doesn't exactly strictly follow the way Lewis describes how it happened, I think this was a good translation for it, as far as basically they said, in a sense, the picture does get bigger. It's like the water in the picture does get bigger and it consumes them. So I thought they did kind of capture the essence of that. And it's not so much they get sucked into the picture. It's more like the stuff in the picture gets sucked into the room. And then I absolutely agree with you, Rillian, as well, about you can't say, oh, this is the moment where they're in Narnia. It's like they... Lucy surfaces, and it's like, oh, they're in Narnia. At the same time, I did think it was really jarring when Lucy surfaced, because we go from a fairly impressive effect scene to a not very impressive effect scene, when you can really tell it's green screen, and the people jumping off the ship don't look good.
Yeah,
so I think that in terms of script and concept, there's no strict point where it happened, but I felt there was a jarring moment where it's like, oh, special effects, okay, they've made the transition now.
Huh. Yeah, I guess, I don't know, I always thought, even in the trailer, I'm not really sure what it is. That one shot of Lucy's head coming out of the water, and then seeing the Dawn Treader there, was, I don't know, there's something about that shot that was not the most attractive angle, in my opinion, for the Don Cheadle. The sweeping helicopter shots are amazing. But
yeah, which we don't get yet. That comes later. Yes. But yeah, I agree. And then I'll say much more so than Lucy surfacing, it's the characters jumping off the ship, which they were given a very heavy motion blur effect, you can tell, to try to disguise the fact that they were fake. And it's really, that was when I was like, oh man, I'm not really feeling this.
Why would they fake that? I don't get it.
It seems to be one of the easier things to do. Guys jumping off a ship, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, it looks weird. I'm not sure exactly how it was done, but it just looks odd. And then when they swim over to them, they go, Edmund or someone says, just so I don't forget this little nitpicky detail here before we move on, but Edmund's like, we're in Narnia, and someone goes, yes, you're in Narnia.
Oh,
no, they
yes,
aren't.
You're right.
They're not in Narnia. They're many, many, many miles east of Narnia. It's a little, I mean, that was one of those mistakes that was like, come on, guys. All you have to do is glance at a map in the back of the book, and you can see that that's not true. They're not in Narnia.
Can I nitpick your nitpick real quick there, Glumpuddle? Because it's called The Chronicles of Narnia, even though one of the books is almost entirely set in Calorman and Arkenland. So Narnia is kind of a catch-all term for this whole alternate universe.
Let me moderate between you two. I would say Glumpuddle. Okay, Ransom, I'll agree with you. I think it'd be perfectly legitimate and understandable for Edmund falling, boom, looking around and saying, we're in Narnia. I completely understand that. The response from someone else on the crew to say, that's right, you're in Narnia. That's where I think it goes.
All right.
I'm not sure I'm even willing to give you that one, Julian, because I would think Edmund's looking around. He's in the middle of nowhere. There's no land in sight. How could he be in Narnia if he's in the middle of the ocean?
Well, at the same time, has Edmund transitioned to any other magical parallel dimensions recently?
Well, I mean, Edmund is perfectly aware that there are more places in this world besides Narnia. He was the king of this
You've
place.
Got a good point.
He's aware of the surrounding countries.
You've got a good point, because in the Prince Caspian,
could say that
they're not...
He could be a little disoriented. He just surfaces in the middle of the ocean. He could be very disoriented.
Drinking too much of that Narnian
in any
water.
Event, I think we can all agree that the response was not appropriate.
I'll agree with that.
I will agree with you, Glumpuddle, that even in Prince Caspian, when they get into Narnia, they're not really quick to jump and say, oh, this is Narnia. So I'll
The looks on their faces say, we got back, awesome. And that's one of my favorite moments of that movie, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then we have another not very good green screen shot where Caspian and Lucy rise out of the water.
That looks odd to me. It's like they just emerge out of this world of water.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just when they rise out of the water that kind of medium shot of the two of them that looks bad. When you have that cool crane shot from behind, that looks really cool.
Yeah, yeah. I will say really quick, even though it's not in the film, I am grateful that we don't have Susan! Oh, sorry, Lucy.
Right.
I wonder if they cut that out. But
I think they did. And I'm telling you, and we'll get to this later, but
we'll get to it later.
I did breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. I spent like about a half second breathing a sigh of relief. Oh, good, that they cut out the Susbian reference. And then later.
Asterisk. And then, okay, we'll talk about that later.
So moving on. So they get on board the deck.
There's a nit, we'll pick it.
Don't pick it or it'll never heal.
But they do get on board the deck of the Dawn Treader. And you have, tell me what you guys think of this real fast. You have Caspian and Edmund kind of, they hug and they act like, oh, it's great to see you and stuff. And did Edmund and Caspian even, did they say a single word of dialogue to each other in Prince Caspian? It just, they never seemed that close to me. So it seems appropriate that Caspian would be like, oh, it's wonderful to see you and everything. But they had this kind of brotherly thing where I didn't feel like they had earned that kind of relationship from Prince Caspian film.
I think I'll kind of agree with you. In a sense, though, I would have to say similar things about the book, because I'm trying to think of a single moment that, okay, they have the bit when they're watching Peter fight. They do talk, both in the film, I think, and in the book, certain there, during the duel. But they never really had a whole lot before then. The one thing I'll give them is that in the movie, certainly you have a sense of pacing where, especially towards the end, okay, they've gone back to the castle and they've done their thing, and I'm sure they talked more than we saw on screen. So it allows more room for the imagination, but I think I wouldn't necessarily... I don't know. I guess if I saw a King of Narnia, that and I'd just be glad to be in Narnia. Oh, hug. Yeah, I guess I could imagine.
Right, I guess. Yeah, I think in the book, I think in the book it is more a respectful, business-like kind of greeting. Oh, it's wonderful to see you. And
right.
I think they kind of took it a little step further in the movie.
I didn't mind that so much. You know, at this point, you kind of just, you know, pick your battles, and that wasn't one that leapt out to me. But
yeah,
it makes sense
enough.
That
it's,
that was
it's
slightly,
one of the reasons
slightly objectionable.
I wasn't feeling that emotionally involved in it because it just seemed like
I'm
not buying into the emotion
of
the characters.
It didn't jump out to me. What did jump out to me, and this is in some ways kind of a clerical error, but it just shows something that they did. I really wondered if the screenwriters had read the rest of the books when they wrote the line for Caspian to say, "High King and Queen of Narnia," because Edmund's not High King and Susan's not the High Queen, and it is specifically Peter's duty as High King, for one thing, above all the rest, he gets the key to shut the gate of Narnia in the last battle, not to ruin it, but so there's a lot of significance there that I think, on one level, it's kind of simple, but then you kind of think, wait, I've never heard anyone else kind of confuse that. It was always clear to me as a little kid.
I don't know if I want to be this podcast anymore because I hadn't even noticed that when I was watching the film. And I've seen line a few times repeated in the trailers. Well, I didn't notice. Yeah, High King. Sorry, behold our castaways, High King and Queen of Narnia. And I thought just now, oh, yeah, Peter's the High King with his brothers and with his brother and sisters, kings and queens under him. Oh.
Well, Ransom, the fact that you didn't notice until now makes me maybe a little more forgiving.
Good.
Well, I guess that was something that did kind of jump out at me. Now, maybe not jump out at me, but just like when they say, oh, we're in Narnia, when they're not in Narnia, it's just one of those little tiny things that makes me go, come on, are you guys really reading these books? Come on, it's just a little annoying fanboy nitpicky detail, but there's a couple two of them really close together, so it was kind of, come on, guys.
Okay, I think I see where you're going here, in that if it was just an isolated incident, it's obviously easily overlookable, but to have that happen more than once and so close together, it seems to denote a pattern.
Yeah, it almost seems like if they're missing little things like that, it's almost like, are they really getting some of the bigger things? Anyway, well, we'll get a bit into that later, but I don't know. It was just a little neat detail. I was kind of annoyed by it. Like, I wasn't like, it didn't kill me or anything. I was just a little bit annoyed by it.
Well, Glumpal, why don't you talk about your little pet peeve with Reepy Cheep's introduction?
Yeah, because Reepy Cheep's introduction in the book is one of my favorite character introductions in the whole series, maybe even more than Puddle Glum, another great introduction. There are a few characters in the series that really get very memorable introductions. And in this case, we have a Reepy Cheep who was definitely a very memorable character in Prince Caspian, not a very important one. But Lewis doesn't immediately tell us who it is. And then it's just the way that Lewis slowly describes every detail of Reepy Cheep, and it seems so poignant and almost epic, you know? The way that was translated in the movie was the first time we see Reepy Cheep, he's soaking wet and he's flip-flopping across the deck of the Dawn Treader, then he stands up and looks, you know, towards the camera.
Why was he wet?
I was like, come on, how can you... He was wet because he had jumped into the water for some reason, I suppose.
That was what I was, because I didn't see him.
What good could he have really done?
Yeah, I don't think I remember seeing him jumping into the water. I didn't see him come up, so I was sort of, I didn't see all
that.
That's
odd. It must have been a cut scene, because why else would you go to the budget work why else would you spend all that money on the special effects? It is very hard to have fur, much less wet fur, in a movie.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's true, we see him. I remember thinking when we first heard that that Eustace was first going to meet Reepy Cheep, that, you know, he was going to, like, wake up in panic. Oh, there's a rat, you know, on my face. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a really cool, you know, way to introduce those two characters. But I didn't think that would be the first time we see Reepy Cheep in the movie. And so I was just thought they took such a memorable introduction from the book and just made it, the whole thing had kind of a slapsticky, comedic feel to it. That was really disappointing.
Well, what did you guys think of Eustace's moment on the Dawn Treader? Because, you know, as we saw this, I'd seen this before, really, pretty much the whole thing in the trailer, and I loved Eustace and always found that the quip from the Minotaur kind of annoying. I thought
unnecessary. And amen. Yes.
I never actually bought. I never understood why the Minotaurs would be on the Dawn Treader. I thought they have hooves. I don't think they'd like being on the Dawn Treader.
Really? Here's why a Minotaur is on the Dawn Treader. Because they're awesome, and we have a Minotaur suit.
Yeah,
and they are awesome.
Well,
okay,
I can understand
granted.
How a Minotaur could be useful on the Dawn Treader just because of how strong they are. There's a scene later in the film. Where the Dawn Treader, they're all having to row, and you can see it takes about two or three people per paddle to row the Dawn Treader, or one Minotaur can take a paddle. And so I think that's kind of what they were getting at. I wasn't hugely bothered by the inclusion of a Minotaur, just because I think you have to represent the Narnian culture we established at the end of Prince Caspian somehow. And so having a faun and a Minotaur mixed in there, I think, is fine. And again, the whole creatures on board the ship was an issue for a while. Didn't bother me hugely. It still feels like an essentially normal crew looking for fantastical lands. I was always worried it would be a fantastical crew looking for fantastical lands, which is not as exciting. Wasn't hugely bothered by that.
I will say, as far as any kind of slapstick humor in the film, this, I thought, worked the best because even though Eustace did not faint in the book, I can actually guess that he probably would have, because we know he kind of had a weak constitution, and I thought it worked pretty well as far as
Eustace was fainting. Eustace fainting was very funny. I thought the way that the Minotaur delivered the line, "You're on the Dawn Treader, one of the fondest ships," or whatever, I thought it was really, really hokey. But I thought Eustace's reaction and the timing of when he falls down was really funny and felt very true to his character.
I liked it.
Agreed.
Ransom, any thoughts?
I was okay with the faint, and I also remember there was a while ago where there was actually a video that someone had taken of Eustace running around the ship and screaming some of his lines. Remember? I was okay with it, even though Book Eustace didn't faint. It makes sense to think that he might have. And, you know, there were so many slapstick moments that went wrong, and that was one of the ones that did go right, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about one of the more... I guess you'd say kind of plot-heavy moments where they decide to kind of move the plot forward. We go into Caspian's cabin, the captain's cabin, and I'll just kind of briefly give my thoughts on the scene. I'll just start off. First off, before we get to the Caspian reference, I was pleasantly surprised to see Caspian clearly state the purpose of this voyage is to find the seven lords that my uncle banished from Narnia.
My heart gave a great leap.
No mention of their swords, and he doesn't mention an oath that he swore, but still, the idea is that it's a very honorable, selfless task that he is setting out on. I was pretty pleased with that, first of all.
I liked that. It gave my heart a great leap. Seven lords, okay, we're on track so far, this voyage is a success. We even see little sketches of them up on the wall. That was a nice touch that I liked.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole reason the lords are gone from the book was changed. In the book, it's, you know, Miraz just sends them out on this on a wild goose chase, essentially, and as he intends, they never return. In the movie that we have here is they were Caspian's father's most loyal supporters, and they fled to the Lone Islands because they knew they were next. Basically, Miraz was going to try to kill him. I didn't have a huge problem with that. I thought that that actually kind of simplified it a little bit. I guess I like the way in the book how it kind of takes the whole theme of exploration and everything, and it kind of makes it more consistent with that. But I thought this simplified it and was totally fine with it.
I thought it worked pretty well. And I thought, okay, good. No extra baggage. Good. There were some parts of the scene, I guess after that, there were a couple moments I thought, when I saw Caspian give Edmund back his flashlight, my first thought is, I want to know where he's buying those batteries, because I need some of those. Narnian air doesn't let them run out as quickly.
I think the Home Depot's influence has spread considerably.
But then, of course, Edmund's kind of got his, thank you. So I guess... I don't know. I would have rather not been there. I think, in Glumfiddle, you and I have kind of always disagreed on why we had a problem with Caspian using Peter's sword. My biggest problem was really that it was Peter's sword. It was something that Peter had identified with him. It was a sword that he was I think he was knighted with...
The sword Rendon with which he killed the wolf.
I always thought that was just something that I thought, I like that this is associated with Peter and doesn't just become a sword of the king, Narsil, that's passed down from one generation to the other.
Yeah, and I think my reason I don't like it is sort of, it's kind of, it's connected with yours, is that it just seems to me it's not consistent. I think that the Pevensey's gifts would be viewed more as like ancient historical artifacts, you know, to be treasured. And I guess if elsewhere in the film, I thought that it was more well established that, oh, Caspian reveres and respects these objects and is kind of in awe of their significance. If that was established more firmly, I wouldn't have a problem so much with Caspian using Peter's sword. But to me, I just because it's not, I think it's just one little thing that doesn't give the audience the right idea about how Caspian feels about how he should feel about the Pevensies. They're like ancient figures out of myth and legend, and these objects are centuries old, and I just think he'd have more respect for them, which I think we did kind of see in this scene a little bit when he was – we clearly have – their gifts being, like, almost on display, you know, being treasured. So I thought that was cool.
I never got that quite, because on one hand, they're treasures, but they're not delicate. And we never get any implication that Rendon is delicate. Like, again, Prince Caspian, he pulls it out, and everything else maybe is, all the other swords are rusty, but this sword is still perfectly clean, doesn't need any cleaning after all these thousands of years. So I didn't really mind that. I think it just seemed to... I liked that it was a gift to Peter, and I mean, he still uses Susan's horn in Prince Caspian.
If it was a choice between like death or using Peter's sword, obviously use Peter's sword. Then, like in the case of Prince Caspian, where they blew the horn at great need, you know, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Ransom.
I think that old things exist to be used as parts to salvage. For the here and now. Not really. But
I don't know. Think about guns from the Civil War.
Those guns old. They're decaying. They're broken. I mean,
how about crossbows from the Dark Ages? This is more what we're talking about here. A thousand thousands of years ago, you know, the Golden Age of Narnia that's passed into myth and legend. And we went over a lot of this in the lead up to Prince Caspian and even a little bit afterwards, I remember. But it wouldn't be a problem, I think, if it wasn't for the seeming ways that perhaps those adapting the book to film didn't understand the significance of the story and the significance of this is like King Arthur coming back, and you know, and some say he will, and I say the sooner the better.
Sooner the better.
Yes, and if it wasn't for that, I would not mind at all the sword being used. But like Glumpuddle was saying, it seems to betray a misunderstanding of we venerate old things not just because we're trapped in some kind of dumb tradition, but because our hearts are in it. We respect these old things. Because they're old, because they meant something to someone else, we honor our history, and we do not just salvage old things like certain fantasy series to get parts for what we want to do with our own agenda. But there, I'm done with my little monologue there. I'm sure there'll be more to say later.
I will agree with you 100%, although I will have to add this caveat. I come from a fencing club that fences with weapons over 100 years old sometimes, so...
I gotta say,
thousands and thousands of years old.
Not thousands; those don't hold up so well.
That's it.
I thought it was a nice touch that because throughout Prince Caspian, the movie, you had this sort of a repeating thing going through it of passing on swords three or four times is used throughout the movie, and they use that. I think they were kind of using that again here, where Caspian's like, "Oh, you should have it." Edmund, I think, almost as a sign of submission to Caspian's authority as the king of Narnia, as the highest authority on the ship, that he says, no, Peter will want you to have it. So I thought that they took that symbol from Prince Caspian and used it again here. So that was a nice touch.
Yeah, I didn't mind their sentiments for one another in that scene and the respect they were trying to show one another. I just think that it was always an understanding that this was... I think I always got the feeling that Edmund would say, no, I can't use it. This was Peter's sword.
Yeah.
It was never my sword, and it was, and I did not, you get the feeling, especially in Prince Caspian, he did not get a sword because of because he betrayed his siblings. But
yeah.
Okay, Glumfiddle, I want you to discuss your hair pulling. First of all, tell us, what was your reaction in the theater the first time you saw it?
I think we just heard it.
I was watching the movie with my brother, and it was, and he said that at this point, remember the mode I'm in? It's, oh, I'm so glad that they didn't have the Suspian reference earlier in the film. And then he says that thing where Lucy's like, so have you found yourself a queen yet? And he's like, no, none to match you, a sister at least. And me and my brother at the same time, it was involuntary. We both went no, like out loud, really loud. I think people kind of looked at us like, oh, sorry, but I was in shock. I was like, the right way to handle Suspian, which Douglas Gresham himself admitted was nonsense. He said. The right way to handle it was to not handle it. Just completely ignore it. It didn't happen. And it was like 10 seconds of Caspian's life. It doesn't have to be referenced again here. There's no need to bring it back. So that felt like, it almost felt like the filmmakers were teasing us. Like, ha ha, we're going to throw in Suspian. They were like, no, why? Why do you have to do that? No.
They may as well have put little letters at the bottom of the screen in the subtitle part where you go, nya, 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 nya. That was my reaction afterwards. At the time, I always do with the Suspian smoocherama at the end of Prince Caspian. Now, I behaved myself and my wife, and I watched the film again before seeing Dawn Treader. It was about a week before. I behaved myself, but otherwise, I will almost always do Gollum. Gollum when he's just caught and he has sting at his throat and he goes, wah! So that's my mature reaction.
Well, I think I don't remember exactly what I did. I think I was, because I was kind of, you know, I kind of sit with my head a little bit forward, and I think I slammed my head back against the back of my seat when that happened. And just go, ah, wait, what? Really?
It's after
what?
After every Narnia movie, when they start making the next Narnia movie, there's this kind of sense of a clean slate, a fresh start. Okay, we can pretend that stupid Caspian Susan thing never happened. Then to have it brought up again in Dawn Treader, it reopened.
The accent is a perfect example. Hey, we found out the accent didn't really work so well, especially for Barnes. Let's just ditch the accent and forget we ever put it in, you know?
Yeah, and I like
we'll forgive him for that.
I thought Ben Barnes did a good job in this movie.
You know, here's the thing. Okay, that little moment there, I do not. Okay, if they were going to do the film, let's say they're going to go for subtlety later on, where they introduce Ramandu's daughter, and they just had that. Let's say they stuck to the dialogue, and there was no actual mentioning on screen. Green or anything that they got married, because the book actually says he went back and they got married. But if I thought, okay, well, if they don't have that, I could understand some mention of, especially to the non-book reader, oh, are you married? No. You know, I don't mind that. Some little mention like that. It was the Susan is my idol. I've got a statue of her, and I have a painting of her larger than life size on my wall. It reminds me.
Okay, really, stop right now. Stop.
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit grossed out here.
At the very least,
it didn't even make sense according to the
right. It reminds me of one of my friends who's. One of my friends was obsessed with Natalie Portman since high school and had a larger than life-size poster on his wall of her. And then one day on Facebook, I see a status come up saying, Natalie Portman is engaged and pregnant. My life is over. And I'm thinking, it's like, this would be Caspian. It's like, oh, Susan's married an English military guy? My life is over. You know? But let's... Let's not dwell on the evils of this world.
Right.
Let's talk about the terrible...
And there is not a whole lot of evil in this world at the beginning, because Caspian does say that there's peace all across Narnia, which
is true.
Nice.
Which is important, because it's essential to the theme of the book that this is not a fight for survival.
We will get into that.
Journey for honor and adventure.
We will?
Moving on to...
Anyway,
our last bit in this podcast.
In the book, the whole idea of the Seven Lords and Ascend Country are introduced in the same scene, Caspian's cabin, and are given basically equal footing, although you could almost say Ascend Country is given higher value because Caspian calls it an even higher hope. And it's clear
exactly.
that it's a hope that the entire crew share, not just Reepicheep, the Reepicheep most of all. Here we set up the whole Seven Lords thing very, very quickly, like everything else in the movie. Then we cut to this really cool, epic shot of the Dawn Shredder where we're just kind of establishing how big it is and everything. And here this kind of annoying, da-da-da-da-da. You're like, what is that? Then finally,
I hated that song.
Oh, it's the mouse singing, and it's not emphasized at all. Then Lucy's like, oh, that's pretty. And so, unlike the book, where you really have to stop reading and read the verse and think about its meaning, here it's just background noise for this really cool shot of the Dawn Shredder.
Okay, real quick about Reepicheep. Despite whatever problems they made with the adaptation, I did like Simon Pegg as the voice of Reepicheep. I thought he did a fantastic job. And he sounded noble. This version of Reepicheep was nobler than the previous one, even if he was just going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, he sounded noble while doing it. And you know that he would have done a good job if they had had it be more in focus, his lullaby and even his explanation, you know, given it more of the weight that it deserved to move the story in that direction. But as at least the three of us, people can disagree, but as the three of us have previously agreed, they decided to make the movie more about a different plot line and not the all-important search for Aslan's country. So it made sense with what they were trying to do. It just wasn't in keeping with the spirit of the book, and it ultimately made it a different voyage.
Yeah, I think, you know, as far as the dignity goes, I mean, the verse is given a lot of dignity. It's set in its own little paragraph in the book, and Lucy says, and let me just start off with this, she says, "But do you think," said Lucy, "Aslan's country would be that sort of country? I mean, the sort you could ever sail to?" "I do not know, madam," said Reepicheep, "but there is this. When I was in my cradle, a woodwoman, a dryad, spoke this verse over me. Where sky and water meet, where the waves grow sweet, doubt not, Reepicheep, to find all you seek. There is the utter east. I do not know what it means, but the spell of it has been on me all my life." So the emphasis there is given a lot of dignity as, like, not only is this important to Reepicheep, but this actually means something, that what the dryad has given him is something important to remember. Not just like, oh yeah, it was really interesting, I just could never forget it. But this is something for him to kind of remember as he goes forward. And of course it is kind of a clue in a sense, not in a, you know, national treasure kind of sense, but just, oh my goodness, the water is sweet. And it connects immediately back to the song.
And it foreshadows the idea that this is not just a peaceful voyage to find seven missing lords. There could be something more to
it. It's true.
You better keep on reading to find out.
Caspian calls
heightening the anticipation.
Caspian calls it a higher hope in the book.
Yes.
And,
mm-hmm.
and also,
yes.
I mean,
but Reepicheep has a higher hope. That's right.
Just consider the context also of the scene where Caspian has explained, oh, this is my main intention, but Reepicheep here has an even higher hope. So Caspian himself, the king, is also saying, but Reepicheep has something that might be even more important. Here, there's never any indication that any of the other characters in the movie are even really care about it or even know anything about Aslan's country, except maybe Lucy. That's not how it is in the book.
Yeah. And that's huge. That makes it it's not something – it's more subjective. It's something just for Reepicheep, something that Reepicheep values. It's not something that actually would be good or helpful to all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, Reepicheep – and another thing this does is it really heightens the anticipation. And if you read the book, there's lots of little moments, you know, from Caspian's speech he gives the troops later on to try to encourage them to go even further. But he says, Reepicheep says, why should we not come to the very eastern end of the world? And what might we find there? I expect to find Aslan's own country. It is always from the east across the sea that the great lion comes to us. So it's kind of building on that, oh, yeah, like you said, maybe there's something more. Wouldn't this be interesting?
Yeah.
It felt like they threw in this scene to say, well, okay, we really do have to end the book at Aslan's country in some way, so we'll put in this little scene just to so people know what it is when we get there.
Some people disagree with me on this, but I just think when Reepicheep is talking about Aslan's country, he doesn't seem like he's talking about the place that he's been basically obsessed with his entire life. He seems like he's talking about Disney World. You know, just a really cool place to go. And all we get is, I only hope I shall earn the right to see it someday. And he does say about the verse, you know, I can't define the meaning, but I've never forgotten the words. And I get the sense like it's something he's kind of been thinking about, but I never get the sense that this is something he's been longing for his entire life.
Well, I'm not sure what about I think about that comment, because on one hand, I've been longing for Disney World my entire life. But I'll agree with... I don't think he sees it as something just trivial or fun, but I do agree with you that he's not passionate about it. This isn't something that he has obsessed over or that he's stayed awake at night thinking about. You know, it's a sort of... Here, it's like, I wonder if this really means anything. Yeah. As opposed to, boy, would I love to find the Outer East, you know, which is more the idea in the book. But
this is where, at least me as a viewer who was hoping for the film to be focused where it needed to be focused, on Aslan's country. This is the goal. This is what it's all been about all along. That's where it started to stray just a little bit from that. And of course, later scenes and dialogue and emphasis would prove that to be the case, that they decided to go in a completely different direction with Aslan's country as a bonus feature instead. But right here, it was okay to me, the Reepa Cheep's rhyme and all of that. But in retrospect, as you both were saying, it was the drums announcing the doom. It wasn't given the heft that it deserved, and one can speculate as to why, but I think it's just an overarching philosophical difference. People have lost the capacity to think and long and yearn for something or some place beyond themselves. It becomes, again, what can I do to, you know, once I get to this fantastic place. It's like Uncle Andrew. He's not looking around at this wondrous creation he's entered into in The Magician's Nephew. He's thinking about, how can I use this? The ground seems to have this principle to it. Let's bring pieces of railway engines and things and bury them and bring up completely newly generated machines and sell them. It seems to be a very similar mindset. Let's just use what we can for our own benefits rather than appreciating it for what it has. In its own self, intrinsic beauty. Yeah. And that was something that C.S. Lewis was all about, which very few people understand now, and we're still all trying to figure it out. But Lewis was close to it, and we really missed that here.
Yeah, I mean, and let me just, at this scene, we're being kind of negative towards the scene so far. And really, the only reason I have some negative things to say about this scene is that this was one of the clips, one of the very few clips I saw before seeing the film. And I had a pretty positive reaction to it, because I thought, wow, I like how it's nice seeing Reepa Cheep talk about Aslan's country. I love Lucy's reaction when she's like, "Do you really think you could actually sail there?" You kind of get a sense of anticipation in Lucy's, in her performance there. I thought Georgie did such a great job. So I had a positive reaction to this clip and a positive reaction in the movie. But what I didn't know was that this is going to be the only time until the very, very end of the movie where Reepa Cheep mentioned Aslan's country. And so although I think this is a very nice moment, in fact, it's one of my favorite scenes in the film as a standalone scene, because it's the only scene in the movie except until the end where we really have Reepa Cheep talk about Aslan's country, then it does kind of feel like it doesn't get the job done.
And that is an excellent point. And it seems to be a bit, just one quick thing here, it seems to come off a little bit as, well, we jumped through that hoop, because it says in script writing school that you can't throw something in at the last minute, deus ex machina. You need to foreshadow it beforehand at least once. So there, that's taken care of. Now we can get to the fun stuff.
I will say, yes, as I was watching the scene, I enjoyed the scene. I liked the scene. I appreciated the scene. But again, like you said, Ransom, in retrospect, like, at the time, I wasn't thinking, hey, wait a minute, this is just Reepa Cheep talking. The whole crew isn't a part of this. This isn't part of Caspian's journey as well. At the time, I wasn't really thinking about that because, yeah, like you said, Glumpuddle, maybe I expected there to be more references, maybe some subtle allusions or, building of anticipation. But, yeah, in retrospect, it's revealing of the larger philosophical difference in what is the purpose of this voyage, and of course we'll talk more about this. Kind of connects really to after the Dark Island scene, which we'll talk about when we get there. But I think you're right, Glumpuddle, that as an isolated moment, I wouldn't have minded if they had, like, even if they decided to say talk about finding Aslan's country and then throw in the poem later, so it was with Lucy. And just save that for a moment with her. Even that, I don't think I would have really minded so much. But because this is the only moment, I think it does. It doesn't help the film as much as it should. I won't say it hurts the film.
No, it doesn't.
This scene, but it doesn't further it. It's insufficient. It's insufficient with what they needed.
No, and to me, it's actually a really. It's kind of a moment in the film where I feel like I'm kind of emotionally connecting a little bit because of Lucy feeling like, "Do you think you'd actually sail there?" This the way she pauses and the way she says it to me, I really feel connected with Lucy. Like, yeah, it makes sense that she would really be interested. Wow, do you really think you could get there? That Lucy, you had this close relationship with Aslan in the first film, and really the second film almost more so. I really buy into that emotionally. So overall, I think this is a nice scene.
Yeah. Well, guys, we do not have any more time.
They're about to reach the Lone Islands, and I think we're about done. My overall thoughts on kind of this section of the film is that there's a lot of large moments that I get to say a number. There's a lot of moments I really, really like, and there's a bunch of little things I really don't like. But my attitude at this point in the film, I think, is, okay, this is kind of starting to go downhill. But, oh, they're at the Lone Islands, maybe it's going to get better now. It's kind of my attitude here, first viewing.
My where I was at this point in the film is I was thinking, okay, some annoying stuff, some things that were maybe some things more they needed, some more strength on the focus of the story. So a lot of things I'm liking. I am thinking at this point, especially when the camera pulls back and you have the helicopter shot sweeping around the Dawn Treader, I thought maybe, just maybe, I've actually stepped on board the Dawn Treader. That's what I was thinking at this point.
And then, of course, it was great having Caspian's intentions about that. It's the Seven Lords, so I'm feeling good about the overall story because of that right now.
I think trying to go back to how I was thinking in the theater and not do chronological snobbery on myself, I think I was perfectly positive by this point. Of course, I wasn't completely emotionally involved. I think I probably still knew I was sitting in a theater and all that. Of course, for me, the 3D threw me off a little bit, and that's a different issue. But
I never watched it.
Yeah, well, I did, and that's the only time I've seen it. But I was optimistic. You know, there were of course the little moments that weighed it down, but I've kind of gotten used to that in some of the parts of the Narnia films past. But I was still on board. I didn't want to jump ship. I wasn't thinking that the green mist is going to take over and it's going to be all downhill from there. I was optimistic. But then came the Lone Islands when things got jarring, and I guess
that's for the next podcast.
That's what I said. Absolutely, yeah. Because our conversation about it will probably last longer than the whole sequence itself.
Oh my goodness. Maybe, you know, you're right.
Actually, we probably just outlasted it. My sentence there just topped the runtime of the Lone Island sequence.
Okay, we'll talk about the quick pacing and the editing later.
Yeah. All right. Sounds like a plan.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much. This was fun.
All right, bye.
Godspeed, y'all.
Further up and further in.